Today we are speaking to our guest about his lessons from the longest study on happiness. We will ask him what brings us happiness and keeps us healthy as we go through life. Many people would think money and fame are the answer to a meaningful life. He will tell us they are not. Our guest today is a Harvard psychiatrist, a Zen priest, and a psychoanalyst. He's the fourth director in history of the Harvard Study of Adult Development, which is possibly the longest study of adult life ever done. For more than 80 years, his team and their predecessors tracked the lives of 724 men. Year after year, they asked about their work, their home lives, and their health, trying to determine what we need for a meaningful and healthy life. About 60 of the original 724 men are still alive, still participating in the study, most of them in their 90s, and they are now studying more than 2,000 baby boomer sons and daughters of these men. Since I watched his TED Talk, which is one of the most popular TED Talks of all time, 37 million viewers, I'm a huge fan of his work and his personal story. We're so honored and proud to have him as our guest in our podcast today.
For almost exactly 4 years, we are now on our way to new work. How can a topic that plays such an important part in our everyday life create more meaning in our lives again? How do we get people to draw strength and motivation from their daily work again? And how can one succeed in living a happy, healthy, productive, and fulfilling life even in such difficult times? We are looking for methods, role models, experiences, tools, and ideas that bring us closer to the core of new work. We are always concerned with the question of whether everyone can really find and live what they really, really want in their innermost being. You are at On the Way to New Work, today with Robert Ardinger.
Hello, how are you, Robert?
It's very good to be here. I'm honored to be able to talk with you.
That is so nice. We are talking from Hamburg to Boston. It's 9 a.m. in the morning for you and 3 p.m. for us. And we are happy. We can see each other, but as you know, it's a podcast, so our listeners will just listen to what we're talking about. And they are used to our first question. They really love this question, which is, how did you become the person you are today?
Ooh, such a big question. I used to think that I became all kinds of disparate pieces and disparate selves, and now I'm beginning to understand that they weave together more than I imagined they would. So I started out in a middle-class family in Iowa. I grew up in Des Moines, Iowa, in the Middle West of the United States. Never knew a psychiatrist, certainly never knew anyone who practiced Zen, never knew anyone who did lifespan research. So none of this was something I ever dreamed of. But I then went from my public secondary school in the Middle West to Harvard College. And at Harvard College, I sort of opened to a whole world of intellectual life and a community that valued ideas and valued study. And that was wonderful because I grew up in a place where the most important things were football and what the girls wore in terms of fashion. And I love those things too, but it was wonderful to be in a place where the things that I also cared about were valued. And so my path led me over and over again to the things that I found that I cared the most about. So within medicine, for example, I discovered that I didn't really care as much about physical disease as I cared about how the mind worked. So for example, in medical school, we learned about the 12 different types of thyroid tumors, but I didn't really care about them unless someone I knew had a thyroid tumor. But I found that once I read about how the mind worked, and I read about psychiatry, I would go home and want to read more. And that began to be my signal, my litmus test, if you will, for what I gravitated toward. And then I began to gravitate toward studying what allowed people to thrive, because my training was in illness, including mental illness. And I found that fascinating, but I also wanted to know what some of the factors were that protected people from illness and that allowed people to be strong even in the face of difficult circumstances. So all of those things brought me toward first psychiatry and then lifespan developmental research, which is what I do. And then I became fascinated with meditation and accidentally wandered into a Zen meditation group, 5-minute walk from my house, thinking I just wanted a little bit of relaxation. And now it's 15 years later, and I find it one of the most important influences, not just on my personal life, but on my work, on my research, and on my clinical work with patients. So all of this is a kind of meandering path toward finding what I do today.
Yeah, that resonates a lot with me, and I'm very happy because I have the same feeling that I'm now 56, that I start to understand why I did things in my life, and now it is getting together to become a picture. But I struggled so many times before, and I always thought, well, what am I doing here, and why am I doing this? And now I can see at least it is a puzzle. There are maybe 5,000 pieces. It's not all together, but it is a puzzle. It's not just random stuff. So, yeah.
Also, for me, it's not all been a smooth path. I tried some things that I really wasn't that suited to and really didn't enjoy. So I started out as a young psychiatrist taking on administrative positions. I ran a training program for psychiatrists. I was an administrator in a clinic. And I realized that I just didn't enjoy that work at all. So even though I could do it, I found it really draining for me and tedious. Fortunately, there are people who love that kind of work. And so what I had to do was try some of these things and realize that I didn't want to do them and then make a change. And fortunately, I was able to make a change, not without difficulty, but I found that the more I kept paying attention to what I didn't like and what was draining for me, and then moved toward what I cared about and what was energizing, the happier I got. And so this was not a perfectly smooth path by any means. I tried things, I didn't enjoy them, didn't do as well at them, and then moved on.
Cool. When was it that you heard first about lifespan studies? And was it the study you're working right now, which was the first contact to this, or had you other contacts to this kind of research before?
I first heard of this when I was a first-year student in medical school. My predecessor, George Valiant, the third director of the study, lectured to my medical school class, and he started telling the stories of these men's lives, these men he was studying and had been studied since they were teenagers. And I sat there listening to this lecture thinking, this is the most interesting thing I could imagine doing. I never dreamed that I would end up working with Dr. Valiant and then running the study eventually. But that's where I first heard of it and wow, found it absolutely fascinating.
Just in case someone is out there not having heard of that one, or is maybe too young to have listened or seen a TED talk, can you give a bit of context of this study and why it's so outstanding?
Yes, yes. This is called the Harvard Study of Adult Development, and as far as we know, it's the longest study of adult life that's ever been done. It started as two separate studies in the year 1938. One group was a group of Harvard College students, undergraduates, 19 years old on average when they entered the study. And they were chosen by their professors as the best and the brightest young men. And the idea was to study normal young adult development. So, of course, they thought if you're going to study normal young adult development, you study all white males from Harvard. It is now the most politically incorrect sample you could possibly have.
Yes.
But that's what they did then. And then the other group, unbeknownst to the Harvard group, was a group of inner city boys from Harvard's poorest families and most disadvantaged, Boston's poorest and most disadvantaged families. There was a law professor, Harvard Law School professor, Sheldon Gluck, and his wife, Eleanor Gluck, who was a social worker. They were interested in why some children from really difficult backgrounds, really difficult homes, why those children were able to stay out of trouble with the law, why they did not become juvenile delinquents. So they studied those children to try to understand what allowed them to thrive, even though every prediction would be that they would get into terrible problems. So the two groups were studied separately and then eventually brought together as comparison groups. And now we've studied these men, 724 total, for 83 years. Almost all have died, but about 60 are still alive. They're all in their 90s, the men who are still alive. And we've just begun to study their children, who are baby boomers. They're in their 50s and 60s on average. And now we are designing the next wave. We're going to reach out to the grandchildren and some of the great-grandchildren. And what we do is we study the big domains of human life. We study physical health, mental health, work life, including work satisfaction. And particularly, we study relationships, both family relationships and intimate relationships, but also friendships and community involvement. So those are the things we study, and we've studied them from 1938 all the way to the present. But as you can imagine, our methods have changed a lot. It went from being just questionnaires that people filled out and interviews, and now we draw blood for DNA and RNA and epigenetic factors. We scan brains. We do all kinds of physical tests and measurements. And so our study is in some ways a history of the technology of human research, because we bring in new methods to study the same basic subjects.
So before we tell the story and the main result, maybe what would one assume? I would assume that a social class has influence on happiness and health. So I would think, yeah, it should be, because they have better treatment, better medication, they have better training in school, stuff like this. They have better food and so on, and maybe they have more contact to sport and stuff like this. And I would assume that there are genetic factors which are influencing it, but it is not, I think. Huh? What is the result, or what are the results?
One of the biggest results has to do with social class. So we know that in our two groups, one started out in the most disadvantaged social class and one very privileged, that the Harvard men, the privileged men, lived on average 10 years longer than the inner city men. And we think that that has a lot to do with both access to good health care and access to education that allowed them to learn about things like the importance of self-care and regular exercise. One of the things we found was that of the inner city men, the 456 of them, only 25 went to university and graduated from university. Those 25 men lived on average just as long as the Harvard men lived. And it wasn't because of their university degrees per se. It was because, we think, of their access to the knowledge about self-care and preventive care that helps people live longer. So we found, for example, no surprise to any of us, right, that smoking shortens your life and creates more disability. Abusing alcohol, abusing drugs, same problem. That regular exercise is enormously helpful. And then I think you're hoping I will talk about the surprising takeaway. Yes.
Well, let's take some time more.
The spoiler that
spoiler.
Yeah. While we will talk about Zen and meditation later, but did you see any influence by people who do meditation and self-care in this direction, mindfulness, that this has an influence?
We didn't study it because, as you can imagine, this was the generation that came of age in World War II and shortly afterwards. Meditation was not something that very many people did at all in the United States at that time. Really, meditation didn't become something that was even known about much until the 1960s and 70s. So almost nobody meditated that we know of. We didn't even ask about it until very much later in people's lives. But we did ask about spiritual practices, and we asked about religious life. And what we found was that being religious and going to church didn't seem to make a difference. That the people who were not involved in spiritual life or religious life lived as long and seemed just as happy. However, what we did find was that many people who were seeking happiness, seeking fulfillment, the people who turned to religion or spiritual practice found it helpful, many of them. So there was a subgroup that did that. And then there were many people who never did anything spiritual, and they lived perfectly long and happy lives as well.
I think we have to get on with the spoiler, you guys. even for me, myself, the tension is rising, and we think we have to talk about it because it's so important these days.
Yeah.
All right. So the spoiler, as you know, is that we found when we were looking at what predicted who would live longer and who would age better, who would stay healthier as they got older. You know, we found, you know, many important things, as I said, about taking care of yourself and taking care of your health. But then what we found was that a very strong predictor of longer life and longer health was the number of relationships you had and the quality of those relationships. Meaning that the people who were more connected to other people and the people who had warmer connections with others stayed healthier longer and lived longer lives. And when we found that, we at first didn't believe our own data. We said, this can't be true, really. And then what we found was that other studies in other parts of the country and other parts of the world were finding the same thing. And that's when we began to say, okay, there is something really important here that we need to look into. So we kept analyzing our data, and we found over and over again, looking at different aspects of it, at different time periods, that the findings were true. We also found that people who felt more isolated, who were more lonely, had poorer health and shorter lives, and that their mental functioning declined sooner as they got older. And again, we found that this was corroborated, that this was confirmed in other research studies. And that's important, as I'm sure you know, because we are just one research study. And one research study, by and large, doesn't prove much of anything in our kind of research, in this lifespan observation research, that you need other studies to confirm your findings. Because one study could just have findings that were idiosyncratic, that happened by chance. And although we do our best to prevent that and check for that, still The important thing is that other studies have found this as well, and they keep finding it over and over again.
Mm-hmm. I've heard about a study done by comparing retired people without having contacts to animals with retired people having animals. And that even the relationship between people and animals can keep you healthy and more happy.
Yes. And we have a hypothesis about that. We have not tested it in our research. But the question is, why would having an animal, why would having a beloved dog or cat keep you healthier or help you live longer? Well, what we think about is stress and stress reduction. So all of us have stress, and all of us need help managing stress. And if you think about it, relationships can do that. If you have someone you trust and you're having a terrible day and you go talk to that person, often you can literally feel your body calm down. You can literally feel your body slow down your heart rate, slow down your breathing. And what we know is that a whole set of physiologic changes happen that are good for you. That the fight or flight response that comes from stress is good if you need to run away from an angry bear, but you don't want that response to go on long term. And if we're chronically stressed, we're chronically in fight or flight response. So having a person or a dog or a cat that will cuddle up to you can be a huge help in reducing the body's physiologic responses to stress. And what we know is that the physiology of stress involves chronic inflammation. It involves effects on the cardiovascular system that gradually break down different body systems. So the more we have this capacity to manage stress, to reduce stress, to calm ourselves down, we believe, and many studies are starting to show this, the greater is the likelihood that we will stay healthier longer.
You said that if you, let's put it like this, loneliness is bad for your health. If you're lonely, it's bad for your health. But you also said that living in a conflict is bad for your health. And earlier you mentioned that a warm relationship is important. I would like to know, also from your personal experience, how important it is to react in a warm way. Let's say if a person seeks conflict with you all the time, and let's say it's a very close relative, and it's very hard to draw away from that. Do you draw a line, or do you react kind and warm? Although, like, what's, you know what I mean? This thin topic. Okay.
And that's, Christoph, it's so important, and it's a really difficult question. So let's take one extreme, which is a violent relationship. And as we know, there are many people in relationships where there's intimate partner violence, for example. Those are relationships that are very destructive. And simply staying there and trying to be sweet and loving while you are getting physically abused is not helpful. And of course, there are many complicated reasons why people are forced to stay in abusive relationships. But at the most extreme level, we know that stepping away from those relationships is important. There's been a study, for example, of very acrimonious marriages where partners fight all the time and high conflict marriages. Those marriages turn out to be worse for your health than marriages that are not high conflict, okay? So then the question is, when do you say this marriage or this relationship is toxic to me and I need to step away? And that each person has to decide, and there are so many balancing factors, as you know, the presence of children, economic factors, so many things. But let's take the vast majority of relationships where conflict is normal. I mean, think about anybody you're close to. There's never a time where you haven't had a disagreement at some point, right? There's never a relationship where you don't disagree. So the real challenge is to figure out ways to manage disagreements and still maintain that bedrock of respect and affection. And when you can do that, there's tremendous potential for growth, actually, when people manage to work out conflicts and remain affectionate. In fact, we studied couples. We had them come into our laboratory and argue with each other. Mm-hmm. And we videotaped them. And we would have them tell us, what are some of the things you usually argue about? It might be money, it might be sex, it might be how you raise the children. And then we'd ask them to pick a topic and argue. And they would forget about our video cameras and they would start arguing. And then we would have independent researchers rate the videotapes for emotion. And of course, there was lots of anger, some more, some less. But the amount of anger in the arguments didn't predict which couples were going to break up 5 years later and which were going to stay together. Guess what predicted which couples, what emotion predicted which couples were going to stay together?
Giving a hug in the end? I don't know. Like hugging each other and say, okay, that's it? Or I don't know.
Well, yeah, it's basically affection. That if you could see, even in the midst of anger, if you could see affection, those were the couples who were likely to stay together. Didn't matter how much they argued or how angry they got. So that's a complex. I've given you a very long answer to your question, Christoph, but it's because it's a really good and complicated question.
Thank you.
But I have another tough one for you. So we are all different, and there are some people who enter a room and everyone turns around and they seem to start new relationships very easily. And there are other people who are shy, who are not that outgoing. Are there any hacks or tricks on how to start new relationships, on how to live good relationships? What could you give us that advice as an advice there? Or is there no such thing as an advice?
It's so complicated. Certainly, what we know from research studies is that people imagine they are not going to enjoy talking to a stranger. They did a study where they had two groups of students, and they assigned one group to go on a bus or a subway train and start a conversation with a stranger, and told another group they didn't need to do that. They could just sit and read their book or their newspaper or watch their phone. And they asked the people who were assigned to talk to a stranger, how much do you think you're going to enjoy this? And most people said they did not think they were going to enjoy talking to a stranger. And then afterwards, they asked them, how much did you enjoy it? And they enjoyed it much more than they expected they would. Mm. So that's just a way of saying that even though you may be, say, in a group of people and think, oh, I'm not going to want to talk to a new person, I don't know, that chances are you will be satisfied, more satisfied than you expect, if you do strike up a conversation with a new person. Not always the case, but more likely than not. The other thing they've done is studied some lonely people who give off signals that drive other people away. And these lonely people don't mean to be giving off these signals, but there are certain social messages that get given out that make other people just gravitate toward the other side of the room. And so they're trying now to learn about what these factors are and how to teach people what they're doing, first of all, to notice, because it's outside of awareness, and then teach people to give off different signals instead. So there is a field of study about this. It's not part of our research, but it's very promising research to help lonely people learn more about making connections.
Und unser heutiger Werbepartner ist das Schnelltest-Hamburg.de-Team. mir sehr eng verbunden, weil meine Kolleginnen und Kollegen von HYROX diese Initiative ins Leben gerufen haben. Wir haben uns sehr früh mit dem Thema Testen beschäftigt, weil wir wissen, dass wir für unsere HYROX-Events natürlich in Zukunft solche Services brauchen und sind jetzt in der Lage, diese Schnelltests auch anzubieten. Wir unterstützen die Stadt Hamburg beim Aufbau von Services und für Privatpersonen gilt, ihr könnt euch dort kostenfrei anmelden. Es gibt eine schnelle Terminvergabe, es sind zertifizierte Tests, die wirklich höchsten aktuellen Standards genügen und es gibt wahrscheinlich schon eine Testlocation bei euch in der Nähe oder wir werden sie bald haben. Aktuell könnt ihr euch anmelden in Barmbek, in Bergedorf, in Hummelsbüttel, in St. Pauli, in Wellingsbüttel, in Eimsbüttel, in Niendorf, bald in der Sternschanze, bald in Flottbek und auch bald am Rathausmarkt und wir arbeiten weiter. Also, wir würden uns freuen, wenn ihr diese Services nutzt, wann immer ihr vielleicht einen Verwandten besuchen wollt, euch sicher sein wollt, dass ihr quasi für die nächsten Stunden nicht ansteckend seid, denn das ist es, was ihr beim Schnelltest herausbekommt, oder für ein Meeting in der Firma, also auf jeden Fall für ganz, ganz viele Menschen relevant. Auch Firmen können sich auf unserer Seite den Service holen. Event Services, das heißt, wenn in einer Firma irgendwie 20 Leute ein größeres Meeting machen wollen, kommen wir dort an und testen alle, sodass nichts passieren kann. Wir sind da mittlerweile sehr erfahren und freuen uns, wenn ihr diesen Service nutzt. Und außerdem, letzter Punkt zu diesem Thema, freuen wir uns natürlich sehr, wenn ihr euch auch bewerbt, denn wir brauchen Personal, medizinisches und nicht medizinisches Personal. Und bewerben könnt ihr euch unter personal@schnelltest-hamburg.de. Wir freuen uns, wenn ihr diese Nachricht auch weiter teilt. Auf meinem LinkedIn-Profil habe ich ein bisschen was dazu veröffentlicht. Gerne sharen, liken, kommentieren. Gemeinsam kommen wir dann durch die Pandemie. Noch ein kleiner Hinweis in eigener Sache. Die aktuelle Folge, die ihr gerade hört mit Robert Waldinger, liegt uns sehr, sehr, sehr am Herzen. Wir würden uns freuen, wenn sie euch auch gefallen hat, ihr mal vielleicht auf den Plattformen bei Apple oder Spotify oder auch sonst mal ein paar Sterne vergibt. Und noch mehr freuen wir uns über Kommentare. Wir haben ganz, ganz tolle Kommentare dort. Uns erreichen auch immer wieder sehr, sehr persönliche und tolle Kommentare auf anderen Kanälen. Aber wir freuen uns, wenn ihr auch dort mal was dazu schreibt, was euch dieser Podcast vielleicht bringt. Vielen Dank und weiter geht's mit der aktuellen Folge.
I have one experience over the last 4 years, which has to do with our podcast. So I was always interested in people and I was always asking questions and we're listening to them, but that's what I get as a feedback from some friends. I lost my attention after 10-15 minutes, and the podcast practice is to really constantly listen to a person for an hour or even up to 3 hours, and over 250 episodes, I believe that I learned to listen much more, and I received so much out of these podcasts that I believe that listening and deep listening is a skill which really helps to keep good relationships in a good manner or to start relationships. So you think listening is a tool?
It's a great tool. It's a really important tool. Curiosity is a really important tool. And so, and which both of you are good at, right? You're good at being curious, at asking questions. So I say something and then you say, well, tell us more about that, right? And of course, people like to talk about themselves. So when you are curious about another person, you are drawing them toward you and they feel valued and they feel like you are interested. So curiosity in and of itself can be a great help. The other thing curiosity can do is help you get a little more deeply into someone's story, because you probably have noticed that some of the people you talk with are not very engaged, and then your mind starts to wander as the listener, and often it's because this person is staying on the surface. And so when you are more curious and can get someone to delve beneath what is superficial, it engages them more, and then you're more engaged as well, and your mind might stop wandering.
When you were talking about also your personal experience, talking about your life, my mind wandered in the direction, how important are the relationships to ourself. I mean, you meditate, so you got to know yourself better. You said you had certain moments. So is there something in the study that shows not only the relationship to other people or pets and animals, but also like to yourself?
Yes. It's such an important issue. The people who seemed both the happiest and the most willing to engage with others were people who could be more self-accepting, people who knew themselves, including their faults, their weaknesses, were less ashamed of them, more self-accepting, if you will, and therefore not afraid to engage with others. One of the things that is the hardest for people is shame. And if you feel a lot of shame and feel the need to hide, it's very difficult to feel safe enough to engage with others. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that happens, for example, in Zen practice, in most spiritual practices, is you learn a lot about yourself. And, you know, I sit on my Zen cushion and all the same stupid, crazy, petty thoughts come up over and over again. And gradually, I become more accepting of that, especially as I talk to my fellow practitioners and I learn from other Zen teachers. And I realize, oh, everybody has these wild minds that think petty, stupid thoughts, even though we know they're not important. So I think that process, and often psychotherapy can do that. You know, psychotherapy can be a wonderful way to help people talk about what they're most sensitive about and feel some shame about and come to be more self-accepting. And that self-acceptance, any process that helps you toward more self-acceptance, I think, leaves you freer to take risks in engaging with other people.
You mentioned loneliness as a big problem. It is part of your TED talk. It is part of your work, and we hear so often that over time more people are lonely. We have more single households. We now hear things like having a department in the ministry in, I think, in the UK and in another country for loneliness. What do you think drives loneliness? Why are more and more people are feeling lonely, are lonely? And we will come to Corona, which drives this later, but without Corona, what do you think is the main driver for this?
Well, a couple of drivers, at least one in the United States, is the tremendous mobility we have now. People, most commonly, people don't live near their families as they grow up, and they move away. There's a lot of mobility in one's work life, right? So you might change jobs 8 times or 10 times in your career, and often you'll change cities where you live. So you and your nuclear family will pick up and move. So fewer people live in extended families or live near their families now. So that decreases your immediate network of contacts, people you see regularly. And then, of course, there's been a lot of study about the role of technology in increasing social isolation. So Robert Putnam is a sociologist at Harvard who did a study of what happened to social capital, he calls it, social engagement, in the 1950s, 60s, all the way to the present. And he was interested, so social capital is this idea that we invest a certain amount in the world. We go out in the community, we join clubs, we go to religious institutions, we have parties, we invite people over. And what Putnam studied was what happened to this kind of activity over time historically. And what he found was that starting in the 1950s in the United States, engagement in the community plummeted. That people stopped going out, they stopped joining clubs, they stopped attending church as regularly, they stopped inviting people over. And guess what that coincided with?
Television. I have no idea.
Television. Yes.
Wow.
The advent of television. Wow. Everyone started staying home, sitting in their living rooms, and watching television.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So then Robert Putnam went back and surveyed the population in the beginning of the 21st century and saw another very great drop in social capital, in social engagement. Exactly, Michael. It's the advent of the smartphone. It's the advent of screens. Okay. Mm-hmm. And of course, people say to you, well, that's okay because I have 1,000 friends on Facebook. But that turns out to not convey the benefits that we are talking about. So one of the things we asked our original subjects, we asked them to list all the people who they could call in the middle of the night if they were sick or scared.
Mm-hmm.
And some people listed like 5-10 people. Some people couldn't list anyone. So if you think about it, this kind of social engagement is really vital in real time, because sometimes you need somebody when you need help. And that usually doesn't come from your 1,000 Facebook friends. That comes from people who you know in the real world.
Robert, something goes through my mind regarding the topic that we have in the podcast. It's called New Work. And there is the hypothesis of the inventor, Fridtjof Bergman, who came up with the term and said, work can become the thing that makes people stronger instead of weaker if it is organized in the right way. But in Germany, we use it only as new work and look at the work part. In the US, they usually call it new work, new culture, including the communities. You build something around the work that is more than just the actual making money. So I just comes to my mind that there is this connection that you said, this engagement in community and this relation to work. I would love to know what you think about work as a value in itself in your study in the long span, and also the work that also engages in the community, this connection, because this is what we are right now lacking. Also, like Michael and I are in the search for that, and we think we need this next level for new work.
Mm-hmm. Work is a tremendous source of social engagement, potentially, because we spend so many hours of our lives mm-hmm. at work. And you probably know that there's been some research now. Some of it, for example, out of the Sloan School at MIT in the US, looking at loneliness at work. So one of the questions that people are asking in business research is, do you have a friend at work? Do you have someone you talk to about personal matters? And the latest statistic that I read was something like 40 to 50% of people don't have anyone at work who they would consider a friend, who they mm-hmm. feel they can talk to about personal matters. What they then do is look at the difference between the people who have a friend at work and the people who don't, in terms of their productivity, in terms of their loyalty to an organization or job turnover. And they find that the people who have friendship at work are more productive and they are less likely to leave their jobs. And so what you can point to when you're talking to business managers is, this will save you money if you set up a situation where people feel more connected to each other at work. They will be happier. They'll work better. They'll go that extra distance in their work because they're enthusiastic, and they're less likely to leave. So the cost of replacing your employees will be less. Did that answer? Was that the question you were?
That's one part. And the second, because you said the engagement in communities has been plumbing. And the question is, if the engagement in communities, if we give it back, like if we say, okay, let's do something that goes beyond just our job and let's look around what's happening right now. I mean, we're all sitting at home, it's Corona time, and we can see what is happening to our direct neighborhood. And is it that you say engaging in that social close community will expand our lives, make us more healthy, luckier, happier?
Absolutely, it will. And I think companies engaging in community activity also reduces this artificial split that we make in our minds between our private life and our work lives. That we think of companies over there, their job is just to make money and to keep their stockholders happy. And then there's the community and there are our families. But actually, the people in those companies over there are the people who are in our families, and they do live in our communities. And so when you see people from a company out in the community doing meaningful work and doing community service, it sort of breaks down that artificial divide that we often get in our minds between community and business.
Let's come to Corona, because I think Corona is something which influences every aspect we're talking about now. And my question would be, what you think will be the impact of Corona on relationships? And maybe you could give us some hint if strong relationships gives us the chance to come better through this pandemic. I could give the answer by myself, but I would love to hear it from you. Yeah.
Well, certainly, you know, I can also speak to our research. So our original study participants didn't go through a pandemic. They were too young for the 1919 flu pandemic, but they went through World War II. They went through the unrest of the Vietnam War. They went through 9/11, which in the United States, as you know, was a terrible upheaval. And when we asked them, what got you through these difficult times? Almost everybody talked about relationships, whether it was, you know, romantic partners, friends, children, fellow soldiers in the war. So everybody cited relationships. And I think that's what we're seeing now in the pandemic as well. The difficulty, of course, with the pandemic is we're cut off from some of the people who we're used to being able to see and some people we desperately want to be able to see. So that has to come back, and it will come back as more and more people are vaccinated and we feel safer to be with each other again. And then we're going to need to invent new ways of being together, particularly being together informally. So if more work happens remotely, so if, you know, I'm sitting, I have not left my home in nearly 12 months. I don't go to my office at Massachusetts General Hospital, and I'm told not to go there. None of my colleagues are there. I do my work here. But if I do that, that means that the casual conversations that I'm used to having can't take place. The person I meet in the hallway by chance, the person who I see and say, let's go have a coffee, I have a few minutes, can we talk? That those kinds of informal get-togethers don't happen. So how are we going to replace those if more of us are working remotely? They need to be replaced because what we find is that those casual interactions are often both very energizing and stress relieving and helpful. And at the same time, they can lead to other important things. I mean, how often have you by chance heard about an opportunity that you never expected to hear about because you just happened to see someone at a coffee shop or at the coffee machine at your office. And so we need some way to replace those casual interactions.
Have there been times that you know of where everyone was told to disconnect to each other? We talk about social distancing for saving lives. I mean, this is exactly the opposite of what you're telling me, telling in the study. And I mean, my son is three, so one third of his life, he has been told to stay on distance with with other people? What will this do to us? Is this not even worse than Corona? I mean, like, how long can we do this?
Yes. It's definitely bad. Whether it's worse than Corona is hard to say, but the mental health toll of this, the cost of it, is huge. So there's much higher rates of depression and anxiety and substance abuse and marital discord and domestic violence. All of those rates are going up significantly in the pandemic. And so what that means is that there's a mental health crisis that we're going to have to address. And again, as people are aware of this, they're trying to bring more resources to that problem. You know, so we're looking for more government funding in the United States for health, mental health care. As you know, mental health care is underfunded. It's poorly funded in the United States. I don't know so much about the European Union, but I imagine that's the case as well. It's not funded on a par with physical healthcare. So we're going to need to address that. And we're going to need to address the delays in child development that happen. I mean, your three-year-old son would probably otherwise be playing with children more of his day, right? And that play is that's his work. That's what he does to develop socially, emotionally, intellectually. So he's going to need to catch up. He won't be alone. All the other three-year-olds in the world are in the same situation. But we're going to have to address that. And it's going to be different for every age group.
Yeah. In Germany, some journalists speak of the lost generation when they talk about the consequences of COVID-19 on young people. Do you think it's really so bad? Or do you think we will come back to normal very soon so that we can... yeah, make them forget this stuff they saw.
I don't think it's either extreme. I don't think the generation is lost. I don't believe that because human beings are so resilient. And if you think about what we are doing now that, you know, and our daily lives where we've been able to work. I have a very full work life, right? I never dreamed this would be possible, right? And we did it in the space of 2 weeks. I changed my whole way of working, as I did, I bet many of you, you know, you two did, and most of the people you know. Okay, so if I think about the adaptability of human beings, then I think we are there's no lost generation, but it is a changed generation. And then at the same time, when you said, Michael, well, we'll go back to normal, it's going to be a new normal. It's going to be different from what it was in many ways. And some of them we are predicting now, and they'll probably come true, those predictions. And some of them we haven't been able to predict. And we're going to see as we go forward.
Yeah, you're right. It's first time in history that we have a 3 or 5 second break, but it's
and
good.
And that shows how important it is. I mean,
absolutely,
like there's so much in here in this conversation. It's really my mind is full, and I mean it in a very positive way, in a flow way. I'm drawing a lot from our conversation here. And I'm our time checker usually. I forget about it. I definitely right now have to check how long we're talking.
Yeah.
It's almost an hour. Oh my goodness, guys.
Yeah.
So for you personally, Michael already mentioned Zen. You talked about the Zen. Let's close the loop, from the beginning and go back there. You had moments when you changed direction in your life. And what was it that gave you the inspiration, the confidence in your life to do that? Did you read books? Did you talk to people? Did you just meditate? Like, where did it come from that you said, something is talking to me?
Well, first of all, often it's unhappiness that is my signal. So I get frustrated or bored or angry and say, what's wrong here? And so that becomes my first signal. And usually it's not happy, right? I'm not enjoying this, but suddenly I say, oh, something's wrong. And so that's the first thing that makes me stop and say, what's happening here for me? And look around and say, what might be, what might need changing? And of course, not everything can change, but I then over time find things that might change. So finding Zen was one of those things where a friend and I had lunch and we both talked about always wishing we had explored meditation. And so we made a vow with each other to find a meditation group and try it out one night. And we did that, and the rest is history. So some of it is that. Some of it is talking to people. So I had lunch with my friend and was talking about needing to make a change and try something new. And it was talking with my friend that made this kind of come together for me. Oh, I really want to try meditation. And then some of it is chance. So I put myself out there, went to a Zen group because the Zen group was meeting at a church that's a 5-minute walk from my house. Nothing more significant than that. I wasn't looking for Zen. I was just looking for relaxation. But by chance, I found a really good Zen teacher, a wonderful person who I felt I could learn from, who was willing to take me on. And I found a whole philosophy and spiritual practice that I resonated with. But there's no way I could have predicted that. So for me, the changes that happen include trying new things and chance. And sometimes what I try doesn't work out, and sometimes what I try works out well.
Mm. Wow. So at the end of our podcast, we have always the kind of same ending. So we were asking our guests, what are your sources of inspiration? And many of them refer to books they've read. Could you name us a couple of books which had influence on your life? As a professor, there are probably hundreds, but maybe the top 3 to 5.
Wow, okay. In terms of fiction, one of the writers who I love is Marilynne Robinson. I don't know if you know her work. She, actually, Barack Obama interviewed her. He loves her. She's a wonderful writer. She's a very talented writer of fiction, but it's spiritually infused fiction. And so I would highly recommend she has written several novels, one called Gilead, which is the first of a trilogy. They're slow, quiet novels, but they're very good. And I'm trying to think what I read a great deal of Buddhist writing and Zen. So I don't know that that's necessarily what your readers want to delve into.
Absolutely. But everything. They are interested in everything from novel to...
There is a book by a Zen teacher named Kosho Uchiyama. And the book is called Opening the Hand of Thought. And it's just a general introduction to what Zen is about.
That sounds interesting to me.
There's another book by a writer who I admire greatly, a Zen teacher. His name is Barry Magid, M-A-G-I-D. And the title of the book is Ending the Pursuit of Happiness.
That's good stuff. That sounds good. And the last question we're asking is about... Bucket list. I don't know if you have a bucket list, but if not, we start to create it for you now. So if you could wish for 3 things for your future, one thing that you want to experience, one thing that you want to learn, and one thing that you want to give back to society, what would be the 3 things on your list?
So one thing I want to experience.
Mm-hmm. One to learn and one to give back.
To learn and one to give back. I would like to experience more new places in nature that I haven't experienced, because I find that those are really powerful experiences for me. So I've never been to Africa and I've never been to Australia, and I would like to go to those places, not so much for the cities, but for the country and the wildlife. Mm. I'd like to go back to the country of Bhutan, although please don't tell your listeners to do that, because it's a country that's not able to handle crowds. But I went once, and it's a wonderful place and a wonderful experience. One thing I would like to learn. Is how to do winter sports as an older person, because I live in a climate with a lot of snow and I'm too old to do the rapid downhill skiing that I used to do. So I want to learn some new ways to enjoy the winter.
Wow.
And tell me the last, it's give to the world.
Yeah.
We formed a foundation called the Lifespan Research Foundation to bring some of these insights about adult life into a form that people can use. And we're developing something that I want to give to the world, basically. We're calling it Roadmaps for Life Transitions. And it's a way to delve into what's happening in your life. It's kind of a life checkup. To say, what do I care the most about? What are my deepest values? Am I living out those values in the ways that I want to? Are there relationships that I want to strengthen, and how can I strengthen those relationships? Are there challenges that I can start meeting in different ways, in better ways? So it's that kind of life checkup that we're developing. And We're just piloting this now, and we're going to start to bring it out into the world. And I am really excited to do that. That's what I'd like to do on that part of my bucket list.
Wow. We would love to talk with you about this when you're ready to talk about public, because it's so, it sounds so good and so important for our time. So thank you so much.
Robert, it was a gift talking to you. I'm just taking notes. There is so much I got to write down now. So thank you so much for that.
You were both really good interviewers, so it was like super easy.
Thank you.
Last question. Who is the president in your group, in your research group?
Who became president? You said like the research group was one president.
Or is it a secret?
I thought you were talking about Joe Biden. No. President in our, John F. Kennedy.
No, you're kidding me.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's a spoiler. Wow.
And the only reason I can tell you that is because it's public knowledge. We commit to confidentiality for all of our study participants, because otherwise we couldn't ask them to tell us personal things about their lives. Mm-hmm. And so it's only the people who have been for whom it's been disclosed publicly through biographies and things like that, those people we can name publicly, and that's why we can tell you that John F. Kennedy was one of our study members.
Wow.
Thank you so much, Robert.
This was a pleasure.
Have a great day.
You too.
Christoph.
Well, I'm pumped with a lot of stuff. I mean, I knew his talk for a long, long, long time, and I just realized again what great of gift we have talking to people. You know me, I learn through talking and listening. That's all I have, and I could feel the connection, and he was so warm and kind. It relates to our podcast with Miriam Priest. I think it's number 75.
It is 75.
And this is an important circle. If you did not listen to that one, it's a German one, you should definitely do that, because she's also talking about relationships, and I can see how important that is. And also listening to myself when I'm unhappy in a situation to move on, which also connects to a podcast with Andrew Huberman, who said something similar, scientist from Stanford who we interviewed. So yeah. A gift, as I said, a gift to me.
Yeah, I think you said it all. For me, it was such a gift when I watched his TED Talk video for the first time. I think I watch it now 20, 25 times or even more often. And it's such a strong message in our times that there is this one recipe for a healthy and a long and a good life, to focus on relationships. And let's never forget this lesson we've got today, and let's continue on our journey.
Word.